Welcome to the Myopia Exchange, our podcast series where we talk all things myopia from research to practice. Today I'd like to welcome Professor Carla Zadnik, Dean of the Ohio State University College of Optometry in the US. Carla is a highly distinguished researcher, a past president of the American Academy of Optometry, and is probably most well known to the myopia community as the study chair for the Collaborative Longitudinal Evaluation of Ethnicity and Refractive Error, or CLEAR study, which lasted for 11 years and resulted in numerous papers, leading to a fundamental understanding on how a variety of anatomical, environmental, and individual factors correlate with refractive error and myopia development in children. If it's a myopia topic you've wondered about, Carla's probably published a paper on it, and she even has her own Wikipedia page. I'm thrilled to speak to Carla today in her capacity as Principal Investigator for the Childhood Atropine for Myopia Progression, or CHAMP study. The CHAMP study is a multi-site, four-year clinical trial currently taking place in the US, UK, and Europe. The CHAMP study is investigating the safety and efficacy of two concentrations of a proprietary atropine formulation manufactured by Nevacar in 0.01% and 0.02% concentrations. Carla and I are also going to have a wide-ranging discussion about other elements of myopia management and how that translates to practice as well. I'm really looking forward to this discussion today. Carla, welcome to the Myopia Exchange.
Kate, thank you so much for inviting me, and it's my pleasure to talk with you across all these miles.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. So let's get into our first question. I'm really fascinated by all we've learned about atropine over the past couple of years. From 0.01% atropine appearing to rule them all after the ATOM 2 5-year study, to then the LAMP study telling us a different concentration-dependent efficacy story, it seems the journey isn't over yet. There's a lot more we need to know. Given that the CHAMP study includes a 0.01% atropine treatment arm, can you describe the CHAMP study design for our listeners?
I would be happy to do that. So the CHAMP study is funded by a company, Nevacar Incorporated, and I will say that I am the principal investigator and a consultant with Nevacar, so I should certainly include that disclosure. And the CHAMP study is a two-stage study, and it will, in stage one, which is 3 years long, evaluate the safety and efficacy of two concentrations of topical atropine compared to placebo for slowing the progression of myopia in children, so treated for 3 years. Stage two begins when stage one finishes in CHAMP, and it is to observe the safety and efficacy in children who are re-randomized, more on that in a minute, to 1 year of treatment with 0.02% atropine or placebo after they've undergone the 3 years of treatment. So there it is, a three-arm, double-masked, placebo-controlled, randomized clinical trial, and the treatment arms are, as Kate's already mentioned, 0.01%, 0.02% atropine, and a placebo. And the children who are enrolled in the study are to be eligible. We're between the ages of 3 and 17. That may sound wide to the audience. Why 3-year-olds? Why 17-year-olds, given what we know about myopia onset and progression? But the primary analysis group were children who were 6 to 10 years old at the time they entered the study. As with most myopia studies, we had to define an entry level of myopia that made the children eligible for the study, and that is as measured by cycloplegic autorefraction, a spherical equivalent refraction of at least minus a half diopter and no more than minus 6 diopters in each eye. Then almost everything else are simply exclusion criteria, which I'm sure anyone who's thought about designing a myopia control study for more than 5 minutes would be able to list as well as I can. And that is that they cannot have significant astigmatism, that is more than a diopter and a half. They cannot have amblyopia or strabismus or other ocular disease. They cannot suffer from any serious systemic illness, and they cannot chronically use other ocular medications. And there's a long list of what that means. So the study's recruitment was completed in August 2019. So if you do the math, that means that stage with the last child enrolled will complete the study in August of 2022, and they will complete the 1 year post randomization, re-randomization phase in August of 2023. The sample includes 576 children. 465 of those were enrolled in the United States at 24 sites, and 111 of those were enrolled in Europe and the UK at 7 sites. So it is a, Nevacar is a pretty small pharmaceutical company, but it's an exciting group to work with because in Sanskrit, Nevacar means new form. And so they are dedicated to finding drugs that might have been approved or are already approved for one purpose and seeing whether they might have another therapeutic purpose. So CHAMP is their first venture into the ophthalmic world, and it's been a wonderfully exciting time to work with people I would never have met otherwise in a study that's dedicated to figuring out more about this complicated atropine study that you described. The dosage, audience might be interested in the dosage. The dosage is a single drop in each eye at bedtime, and the package is an unpreserved minim. So they use one small bottle, if you will, of it and put one drop in each eye, and then that gets thrown away and they use a fresh one the next night. So it's a little bit different perhaps than some of the compounded atropine with preservatives that people are using around the world as we wait to learn more about atropine and possibly have a manufactured version of atropine that we can use for our patients.
That's fascinating. I didn't know that Nevacar was Sanskrit for new form, and I think that that perfectly encapsulates what we still need to learn about atropine, as you've said. I think the thing that's really interesting about atropine 0.01% and or atropine in general is we presume that all atropines are similar, but we don't presume all multifocal contact lenses are similar. You know, there's new forms of multifocal contact lenses currently being investigated and similar interest in understanding lens design in Ortho-K. So I think that's really interesting to understand that just because we've had a handful of studies on atropine doesn't mean we know everything, and that it's so important for research to continue. And I guess also research in multiple sites, because a lot of atropine studies have come out of Asian countries. So it's important to understand how these treatments work on children of different ethnicities and in different environments as well. So I think that's really interesting to understand. And I just wanted to pick up on something you talked about. So your primary analysis group, you said, were children aged 6 to 10 years. And in talking about how we put myopia control into practice, how do you think practicing optometrists should make decisions about how to manage an individual child's myopia?
I think this is a challenging time to answer that question. And the reason I say that is we have so much information coming at us from all different kinds of arenas. So we have clinical trials that we can read the primary source, which is, as I tell my students, always sort of my favorite. And then we have meta-analyses or literature reviews or Cochrane Library reviews that attempt to distill all the studies to date of either a particular modality or across modalities. And I've sometimes read a paper and I'm reading along and thinking, oh, wait a minute, I've already read all of these primary sources. Now, how do I factor in this meta-analysis into the picture that I, as a clinician, would be trying to build to answer your question about what should I do about the one child that's in my chair today? So I do firmly believe that optometrist education around the world should not end the day they graduate from optometry school. I think back to when I did that, and I shudder to think how limited my knowledge would be given what's happened in the ensuing decades. And so I really believe in original sources and reading them. So I think the value of a podcast, the value of a website, the value of a Facebook feed is that it drives practitioners to those original papers. And so they're not only looking at the central trends of a particular treatment, on a child of a particular age. But if they actually read the paper and look at the data, they can also see the distribution of the effect that happened with that particular treatment. And they can think about where the child who's sitting in their chair might sit in that distribution. I don't really believe in relying on any kind of calculator that extends what we know from 2 and 3 year long studies to a child's entire myopia development period. I don't believe on hanging my hat on a single continuing education speaker's opinion. I like to read them, but I don't think they should drive my decisions. That is, anecdotes on Facebook about an individual child's experience. In fact, what I see on Facebook often are people asking about that individual child in their chair, and people then providing their read or their best read of the evidence. And so I'm very old-fashioned in this regard of thinking that in myopia treatment, and I'm going to say in eye care in general, that that idea of an evidence basis that is truly read and digest the published papers and form one's own clinical decision about the child who's sitting in that chair. So that's not a recipe. That's not a flow chart. That's probably a deliberately unsatisfying answer to the clinician who's going to see that kid tomorrow morning somewhere. But I think that's where we need to get as a profession who is making truly informed decisions for our patients.
I think that's a very realistic reflection of the fact that we have a vast amount of research to understand and to attempt to translate into practice. But we also really have to look at the child in the chair just simply in terms of their capabilities and even their family's capabilities. And we can't necessarily formulaically fit them into a flowchart because each child's an individual and each family will have different circumstances as well. And I'd like to explore that a little bit more with you a little bit later on. But in talking about primary sources, something I'm keen to ask you is, we know that the CLEAR study has generated an incredible volume of understanding on factors which influence and don't influence myopia development. And this covered a variety of topics from family history, outdoor time, near work, sports, nighttime lighting, peripheral refraction, accommodative lag, cornea and lens and axial length and even more, the whole gamut of factors. That's a pretty big list of factors that could influence myopia in an enormous amount of papers that were published from that data set. So just for purely my own nerdy interest, do you have a favorite CLEAR paper?
So that's like asking who's my favorite child, but let me try. If I had one child of each gender, I'd say, you know, that's my favorite son or that's my favorite daughter, but I have two daughters, so I'm not going there. I'm going to say I have two, so I'll do them in chronological order. The first is the paper that Lisa Jones is the first author in 2007 in Investigative Ophthalmology and Visual Science. And that is really on the Arinda Longitudinal Study of Myopia data. So CLEAR emerged from the Arinda Longitudinal Study of Myopia when, through funding from the federal government in the United States, we were given the opportunity to expand our database from a group, a predominantly white group of children in Northern California, to a much more racial and ethnically diverse group across the country. So the Arinda study morphed into CLEAR. And that paper in 2007 on the Arinda data was the first, to the best of my knowledge, that reported the protective association of time outdoors for the onset of juvenile myopia. And a little story, when we were designing the Arinda study, we added outdoor activity to the parents' questionnaire. How many hours per week does your child spend outdoors or in sports activities outdoors? As almost an afterthought, Kate, it was sort of like, oh, we're asking them about how much they read and we're asking them how much they play video games and watch TV. Maybe we should ask them how much they're outside. And it was that literally that ill-informed a decision. We just added it to kind of complete the puzzle. And when we started to analyze the data for that 2007 paper, it was an association that we literally statistically kept trying to make go away. it can't be real. That can't possibly be the real thing. And we just, you know, couldn't figure out a way to make it go away. So those data, by the nature of the Arundel study data, are longitudinal. So we enrolled children at the age of average 6, followed them in time. So we watched, you know, we saw their first myopic visit. It wasn't historical. It wasn't a cross-sectional study. And we were perhaps as surprised as anybody when papers then later out of Australia and Singapore in very different samples replicated our finding. So that's really my most favorite paper, only because of sort of the serendipity that led to an unexpected result. And now I almost can't pick up a journal that has some mention of myopia that doesn't talk about something about time outdoors. So it's pretty wild to think about your work leading to something that truly affects what practitioners are telling parents about how to keep their children from becoming myopic. Like, that's just beyond cool. My second favorite, however, is really the paper that was the main specific aim of our grant that we wrote way back in the day, and that was to figure out how we could predict the onset of myopia in kids. And that goal of that paper was, we kept saying that if we ever had a treatment that we could, let's say it's an eye drop, that we could apply before the onset of myopia and actually prevent it, wouldn't we want to know who was at risk for getting it? So I used to call that drop Grow No More, but now my new name for it is Mynopia. And so that's really our primary aim. How do we predict the onset of myopia, given that we started with a bunch of mostly emmetropes and low to moderate hyperopes? And that's our 2015 paper in JAMA Ophthalmology. And clinicians listening might go, oh, I know what she's going to say next. I haven't read the paper, but I have a feeling that I know what predicts myopia better than anything else. And if your guess is refractive error, that is how close a child is to the myopic cliff at some number of years before they drop off of it, you would be exactly right. So there are a series of cut points. They're this much hyperopic by this age, and therefore they have a higher likelihood of developing myopia. So those are my two favorite clear children across the years. But I was pleased to hear your long list of things we've investigated, because I'm thinking, when do you have time to do anything but read the literature? So that was fairly impressive. Thanks.
Well, thank you so much for putting all of that knowledge out into the world. And I won't tell your other clear children that you picked two clear favorites. So I won't tell them your secret's safe with me and all of our many listeners. But I was very interested too. I definitely picked that 2015 JAMA Ophthalmology paper as well as one of my favorites. And I'm allowed to say that because they're not my children, of course. And the thing that I really liked about that paper is how there's an incredibly complex amount of maths in that paper, and then it leads to something that, as you said, translates very readily into clinical practice. And having that impact in changing practice patterns, as you said, is really what it's all about for a researcher to really see that that's changing how children's care is going forward out in the world. So I'd like to just circle back to just picking up on something you mentioned about the CHAMP study. So the CHAMP study is investigating children aged 3 to 17, but you mentioned that your primary analysis group are children aged 6 to 10 years and their refractive error is -050 to -6. So if we think about those children as our typical targets for myopia control, and I'd like to investigate that, just explore that a little bit with you. If we're thinking about them as our primary targets, we need to think about for whom myopia control might be appropriate and for whom perhaps it isn't so appropriate. And some members of our community have taken a very strong stance from the podium that myopia treatment control should be discussed with all parents of children with myopia as the best option, and that this has become standard of care. What are your thoughts on that recommendation in terms of children who really need myopia interventions and children for whom we may need to take other factors into account?
So I think that stance of saying, you know, our evidence is at a point that we should unequivocally be recommending this to every parent of every myopic child creates a real dilemma. And as you can imagine, in the United States today, with the killing of many Black folks at the hands of the police department, I'm spending a lot of my time as an optometric administrator, thinking about health disparities, social determinants of health, why in the United States the risk of dying from COVID-19 is higher if you're Black, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm worried that if we take that strong a stance, like, mom, this is the right thing to do for your child, and we have a treatment that is self-pay, which is really what myopia treatment still is, then what new health disparity are we introducing for that family? Would that mother have to make a decision about whether or not she could pay for her child's myopia control, or, I hate to be dramatic, but or to feed her family, or what other things might a family be giving up? And yes, we're eye care practitioners, and yes, eye should be really important to us, but I think we just have to be very cautious with our language and the expectations we set for families that we're not adding to socioeconomic-based health disparities in different groups of children. Now, having said that, there's another solution to that problem, and that would be that we continue to assemble our body of knowledge, and in fact, our body of knowledge becomes so strong, so obvious, it's so undeniable that in fact, that's when medical and vision third-party payers start to cover treatment, and then that problem starts to go away as long as the families that you're identifying the treatment option to, more often than not, have an insurance that covers that. So it's not, you know, I'm not talking about denying parents knowledge about the treatment that might be available for their children, but I'm trying to think about how we don't put a new pressure on parents who simply do not have the financial resources to avail their children of that opportunity.
I think that's a universal issue and a universal consideration for optometrists and eye care professionals right across the world, absolutely. And in the US context, that's really important and very timely given what's happening in the world at the moment. But I remember talking to Pauline Cho, who's from Hong Kong, at the International Myopia Conference last year. And she had a similar message, I guess, in saying that, you know, they've had parents in the clinic with three myopic children, because in Hong Kong, it's likely that all the children will be myopic at some point, and parents in tears because they can't afford Ortho-K for all three of their children, and so they've got to pick a child, essentially. And that, I think, involves compassionate and sensitive healthcare, doesn't it? It involves really understanding the capacity of the family and the capacity of the child, and as you said, not denying them knowledge, but also not pushing them into something which isn't necessarily affordable or isn't necessarily going to be of maximum benefit for their child. So I know in the discussion that I'd had with Pauline Cho that she'd talked about targeting children who are more likely to be fast progressors or younger children. And I guess I was thinking about that and what you've said in view of the CHAMP study and your primary analysis group being children aged 6 to 10 years. So do you think that there's a group of patients for whom we really need to have these discussions, for whom we really want to ensure we're not denying knowledge, and then children for whom perhaps we can be a little bit more relaxed about these discussions? Do you have any sense of that from your understanding and from your research?
We are actually working currently on two different papers that talk about, from the CLEAR data set, talk about that, our ability to predict who's going to be a fast progressor. So we'd love to do that for clinical treatment. You can also imagine we'd love to do that in designing future randomized clinical trials, because we could enrich the sample from the very beginning with children that we knew were at high risk for rapid progression. So stay tuned for those papers. I'll give a little bit of a prediction, or a little foretelling, which is it's not as easy as it sounds. Now, having said that, many of us would say, especially we look back at our JAMA paper, many of us would say, oh, I've got a five-year-old in my chair and they're already a minus one. That's terribly atypical for a five-year-old. And then we look at mom and dad, and mom and dad turn out to be minus eight and minus 10 each. But of course, one of the big questions is that largely, our randomized clinical trials do not include large samples of, what do I want to call them, those future high myopes. And we're not even assured that the five-year-old who's minus one is going to, which treatment might be the most efficacious for that child of the one, of the treatments that we have in our armamentarium. And so I think that might be the child that we would all, of course, say, oh, I really ought to have that myopia treatment conversation with these parents, and the parents, the minus 10 and the minus 8 who are sitting there, are absolutely going to want to have that conversation. But I think what we just discussed about affordability, about the ability of that family to comply, whatever other factors are going on in their family lives, are also terribly important for us to consider as clinicians. And that's maybe why we can't just read one paper, you know, one paper on ortho-K and one paper on multifocal contact lenses, on one paper on atropine, and we're done and we've got it. And we don't have to think about that individual child in the chair and all the family dynamic and social determinants that might affect the advice we will give them.
Thank you so much. I think that's a really fantastic, wide-ranging discussion we've had, and some really important clinical pearls, and not even necessarily prescribing pearls, but clinical pearls about communication, about how we take care of our patients and how we put this new and emerging and growing area of research into practice. So, Carla, I'd like to thank you so much for your time. I think you've given us a lot to think about, a lot of papers to go forward and read, and some of your favourites, although we won't tell the papers which are your favourite papers. And I'd like to say thank you very much for this conversation and for your message. And it's been great having a chat to you. Thank you so much.
Kate, you're so welcome. Thanks for inviting me.